from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome to another installment of Market Movers. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me at the helm, Yochai Elam. Hi Yochai, how you doing?
Hi Lior, I'm doing great. All geared for a busy week.
Today we're going to talk about and we'll examine the Fed's policy and its impact on the US inflation. Then we'll shoot off to see the main news items of this week, including the Fed's statement, the GDP for Q2 in the US, non-farm payroll report, and sign off with the personal consumption expenditure. So let's kick it off with the Fed's policy and how does it impact the US inflation, or if it will impact the US inflation. Because as you well know, there are a lot of people who have concerns regarding that the recent policies of the FOMC has expanded the balance sheet and the low interest rate could eventually lead to a sudden eruption in the US inflation. It's imminent. Is that true? What do we see from the figures point of view, and are there any evidence to support these kind of concerns? So let's start with a quick review of what the Fed has done in recent years in order to fight the recent crisis from 2008. First of all, they started off with the conventional methods that they have at their disposal, which is, of course, lowering interest rate. When they reached zero bound, they had no more conventional methods to do. So after that, one of the things that they starting to shift the balance sheet, expanding the balance sheet, and setting the cash rate low, and they committing to keep the cash rate low until mid-2015. So this method, along with expanding the balance sheet with a quantitative easing, basically the Fed purchases long-term securities and expanding the balance sheet. By that, disposing these funds to the banks in an attempt to jumpstart the economy. With addition to that, they also shifted the balance sheet and started to purchase long-term securities in exchange for a short-term, in order also to make a little bit pressure on short-term yields and also try to expand the money base. This was all these methods were intended. That's what they wanted. Kicked off the economy and see that it's going on the right direction. How these kind of methods had an impact on the US economy up until now?
Well, I think they did have some effect, the Fed says, on the wealth effect. It means there was more money in the markets, house prices began rising once again, equity markets began rising once again. It had some effect on raising confidence. People felt that at least there's one person or one institution that is taking care of business, and that's the Federal Reserve, while the politicians are still in a stalemate, and they were in such a stalemate for quite a few years. So I think it did have effect on confidence. However, banks have a lot of cash, a lot of liquidity, and they're not doing with it too much, even though interest rates are low. Banks are not lending out money, and businesses are not really borrowing that much money.
Funny that you talk about, because in a recent article I wrote on this specific issue, I've noticed that while the money base has expanded very rapidly, and the money base is the most liquid measure of the money supply, and that's where your Fed's policy goes into effect. Now, in the past 4 years, money base expanded by nearly 100%, 95% from January 2010 till now, till July, it rose by 95%. But if you look at M2, which is another measure but a more broader classification of money, and it's also used as a key indicator for the forecast of the inflation, and it basically includes the bank deposit and the public short-term deposit. If you look at that, you'll see that M2 rose by only 35%. So even though the money base expanded, most notably because of QE1, 2, and 3 that the Fed implemented, in effect, when you see the money supply, it didn't translate and didn't trickle down as much as they wanted, because one of the reasons, as you said, because the banks were hoarding the cash and then they spread it around. So that's where the money is. The Fed printing the money doesn't come back to the public, and you only see a 35% gain over the past 4 years, even though the money base expanded by 100%. Double the money base, and still you don't see it in the money supply, the M2, which is the public's short-term deposits and the bank's deposits, where you actually do transactions. So there is that. But in effect, these kind of measures were also meant to see that how the economy will start expanding again, and we saw a little bit of it in regards to the GDP in recent years. Except Q1, the first quarter, we'll refer to it later on in the show, and core consumer price index rose in the last month to 1.9% on a yearly scale, which is kind of close to the annual rate, I think. So we're getting a little bit closer to what's the Fed's policy's direction.
Right.
But at the same time, we also have other measures that Yellen referred to in their last FOMC meeting, PCE, that reached only 1.5%. So all these numbers, I bombarded with all these numbers, but the basic line is that even though the Fed expanded its policy, made a lot of dovish efforts in order to jumpstart the economy, eventually, when you see the inflation, when it comes to the money supply, when it comes to other measurements such as the core CPI and the personal consumption expenditure, the PCE, we see that there are very little actual impact on the inflation. So the fear that we'll have suddenly a sharp rise in the inflation, at least for now, it doesn't seem it has much of a validity.
Yeah.
What's your take on it?
Well, basically, we know we can argue if quantitative easing, if this $4 trillion balance sheet of the Fed helped the economy or if it didn't help the economy. What we can say for sure at this point, after 5 years or so of this kind of policy, is that it did not create inflation. No matter how you measure inflation, it's just not there. So all the doomsayers, all the scares about inflation, hyperinflation, Zimbabwe-style inflation, Weimar-style inflation, it's just not there. What did change in recent months is as the economy continues growing and the balance sheet also continues growing, because despite QE tapering, the Fed is still enlarging, it's still buying bonds, it's still enacting quantitative easing. It's just the pace of tightening is, the pace of loosening is tightened, but it isn't monetary tightening per se. So what we're beginning to hear now is more serious people also talk about the dangers of inflation. Not that this danger is imminent, but there is a lag between monetary policy and inflation and the job market. And the big question that everybody is asking now, or those in economic circles at least, is the Fed still ahead of the curve? Because we know that, for instance, the Fed started QE2 to prevent deflation. Deflation was not seen at that time, but the Fed has the tools to forecast, to make assumptions, to see what it thinks will happen in the future. So it prevented deflation. Oh well, we can't wind back the wheel and know exactly what happened, but it didn't create inflation with QE2. The big question now is the Fed too dovish, and is it behind the curve? Is it falling behind the curve? Will it tighten its monetary policy too late and inflation will rage? Now, I don't think it's going to happen, but we have to be aware that there are growing voices also within the hawkish members of the Fed, but also more serious economists are also hinting that it's time to acknowledge the improvement, it's time to begin tightening policy, perhaps at a faster pace than the market thinks.
But on the other hand, you also have those other economists, including note Paul Krugman, that continues to slam the Fed and says that it doesn't do enough, that has to do more, like inflation targeting and raising maybe the inflation target from 2% to 4%, or pegging the long-term interest rates to bring down demand for long-term treasuries. All these kind of factors that might also have some additional impact on the U.S. economy and raise it from its current stagnation. But for one thing, the inflation target of raising it from 2% to 4%, it's not something that central banks want to do to begin with. And for the other reason is that I don't think that the Fed, even if it wanted to raise the bar to 4%, it could do it, because with their current policy, they barely reach the 2% mark. And other economies are facing same issues. The ECB has its target at 2%, and now the inflation is what, 0.5%?
0.5%, and core inflation is only at 0.8%.
Yeah, and the Bank of Japan also have a similar rate, and it's nowhere near its target. So we have other countries that face this similar problem. And even though they have a low target, it's not like as if they will raise the target from 2% to 4% or 5%. It will do anything, because the U.S. economy doesn't react to it, as we see. Because now with 2%, the U.S. inflation barely reaches it. So there's
right.
That to consider. I think that you're right on that the Fed is starting to shift back to become a little bit more hawkish. And even Yellen, who is more dovish, just like a predecessor, Bernanke, she'll probably start leaning towards raising interest rate and maybe step a little bit back from the Fed's expanding policy. Where is it at? Which brings us to this week's main news items. We have the FOMC's meeting. They started today, July 29th, and will end tomorrow, July 30th, with the statement. What's your take on it? You think that we'll see some fireworks, or just the regular $10 billion taper and that's it?
Well, I think the Fed will do anything it can not to set any fireworks this time. Well, the easy explanation is that there's no press conference and no staff projections this time. So it'll probably leave the fireworks to September after the summer vacation. That's just from practical reason. In addition, so what we expect is a taper of $10 billion for the sixth time to $25 billion US dollars per month. Another taper is expected in September to 15, and then a last taper in October from 15 to 0, practically the end of quantitative easing. So there's no press conference, no staff projections, so the focus will be on the statement. Now, I believe we'll see the following things in the statement. A move towards a more bullish view on the job market. There has been improvement in the non-farm payrolls, in the JALTS figure, which is a Fed favorite, in jobless claims that were very low, steadily low, and then fell even lower last week. They might also show some concern, on the other hand, about housing. We've seen pending home sales, new home sales, both disappoint, so did building permits and housing starts. This has been a point of concern for the Fed in the past, and I think they'll maintain this concern.
But is it really a problem in the housing market? Because in at least from what I saw in the new home sales, there was a decline from month over month in June. But eventually, if you look at the new home sales in the past 6 months, it was pretty much stable with fluctuations around 5 to 10%. But is there any reason to be concerned that the housing market doesn't heat up too much? Because that's what you want. No, you don't. You want the housing market to show some progress, but you don't want it to overheat. And as we still feel the burn from 2008, that's, I think, the last thing that the Fed wants is another bubble in the housing market.
You're absolutely right. The Fed doesn't want to see another bubble. At some point in past months, the year-over-year rise in house prices has been in double digits, 12-13%. This is not healthy over time. However, there is a strong correlation between the housing sector and economic growth. So a too significant slowdown in the housing sector would be of concern to the Fed. And in addition, I think that if the Fed would like to maintain a relatively balanced statement, it could balance the more bullish view of the job market with some more concern about housing. All in all, I believe that they wish not to rock the boat too much. I think towards the release of the statement, there's been a lot of hype in the market about what we've talked about before, about tightening, moving to a more hawkish direction, getting ahead of the curve regarding inflation, acknowledging the improvement in the job market. But it's been, in my opinion, too hyped. So if we get a relatively cautious, balanced statement from the Federal Reserve, the dollar bulls could be disappointed, and I speculate that we'll see some sell-off of the US dollar in a knee-jerk reaction to the statement.
Oh, so you anticipate we'll see a little bit of the weakening of the US dollar against leading currencies?
Yeah, because there's just too much anticipation. While we speak, euro dollar fell to a new low. A new low since November 2013, it's digging lower. The same is happening with the Canadian dollar, New Zealand dollar, and also the British pound fell off the lows. We talked about it last time. So there's a bit too much of a build-up towards the statement, and I think we'll see the necessary profit-taking that would be triggered by the release of the statement. And the Fed might go hawkish, it'll just leave that for September.
Oh, okay. So that was also a little bit of the case last time, right? Even though they continue with their tapering of QE3 and revised down the economic outlook, still they were a little bit more hawkish, especially with the Yellen's press conference, which led to a decline in the US dollar, and also gold and silver bounce back at FOMC meeting. So we saw that, so what we saw is that in last meeting, following tapering of QE3 and after the Fed revised down the economic outlook, there were sellouts in the US dollar, and also gold and silver bounce back, even though in the preceding meetings, we saw a systematic fall in gold and silver prices following the FOMC's decisions to taper QE3. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not we'll see another resume of the decline in gold and silver, or we see, as Yochai suggested, that we'll see another sell-off of the US dollar, which will probably be in line with the recovery of gold and silver.
Yeah, and let me just mention the hawkish scenario, which is one specific word in the statement, and that word is considerable. There is There are very few analysts, but I'll still voice their concerns or speculations, that they say that the Fed might remove the word considerable time for a rate hike after QE ends.
Oh no, what will do without considerable? That's not cool.
Yeah, it's a long word with many syllables.
The Fed without considerable? Now I don't know how I'm going to read their statement again. It's just not going to be the same. Let's put it this way.
Yeah, well, back in March, 4 months ago, Yellen was asked about what does considerable time mean. And she said, well, something like 6 months.
Now when we go to Dexter Dictionary, we'll see considerable under 6 months. So that's what we're going to see, right?
Yeah.
So just revised now the dictionary, yeah.
Yeah, if anybody wants to study English, can now learn a new word. Yeah. And the meaning of it.
The meaning of considerable. The meaning of considerable, the 6 months. Okay, that's nice to know.
Exactly. So some are speculating that the Fed will take a step forward, make this semantic change to the statement, remove the word considerable, just say that between the end of QE and the rate hike, there will be some time or a bit of time, or the Fed will wait between the end of QE in October and until a rate hike. Any such a semantic change will likely give fuel to dollar bulls. It will be a significant change, even though it's only semantic. However, I still think that the chance that they will do it now is quite low.
Okay, so we might see it, but in the following meeting, not in this one, but in September.
Yeah, I think in September we'll see not only a change in the statement, but more importantly, I think that Yellen in her press conference will begin explaining the exit strategy, and by then we'll have a better picture of the US economy, especially updated data for Q2. This week we only have the initial figure, and as we've seen in Q1, there were huge revisions. So I think by the September meeting, they'll have more significant amount of data for Q2.
Okay, so which brings us to the GDP, which will also be released this week, and we'll see what kind of a shift we'll have in the US economy from Q1 to Q2. Obviously, all the expectations will be that the GDP will be significantly higher than what it was in Q1, right? What are the figures now? What are the current expectations?
Okay, so for the second quarter of 2014, the US economy is expected to have grown at an annual rate of 3.1%. That's clear rebound from Q1.
Was it only because of the weather or just a matter of seasonality? What happened in Q1 that suddenly was all fixed and became so much better in Q2?
Well, the weather was a significant issue. The storms that the United States experienced, the recurring storms in January, February, and also in the beginning of March, and I think in December as well, were quite strong. So there was less retail activity. However, many people buy on Amazon and other online sites, so they could continue doing it at home. There weren't blackouts. So more reasons for the weakness in the first quarter were also a depletion of inventories. So that's actually not a bad thing, because these inventories have to be replenished. They have to be built up once again. So that's one reason for a rebound. Another thing was the revisions that were made to the assessment of healthcare costs. Let's remind everybody, the ACA, Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, came into effect at the end of 2013 and was really felt in early 2014. We don't know exactly how to calculate it just yet. So that's what caused huge revisions from a small growth rate of 0.1, then to a contraction of 1%, and finally to a contraction of 2.9%. In any case, the Fed expects a recovery, everybody expects a recovery that lasts in Q2 and also beyond. Another thing to watch out for this GDP report is that it also consists of revisions to past figures. So basically, for every GDP release, every quarter we have three releases. The initial one, which we have this week, and then two revisions. The last one is called final, but it's not really final, because after some time, methodology is changed, different things are accounted for, some things are not accounted for, more data comes to light, and there are revisions. Usually this happens now in the summer, and we could have revisions of Q1 and also of 2013 and even 2012.
But the first one is the most significant one, right? The flash report, the first estimate of the quarterly growth rate That was the one that usually has the most impact on the financial markets and revises the progress, right?
That's right. So the first release has the strongest impact because in the past, revisions were not that huge. Given the huge revisions we had in Q1, I think that also the second release and the third release will have a significant impact as well. So I expect the market reaction to be first directed towards the headline figure, which is expected to be 3.1. But then I think markets will look into the details, if this growth is more of inventories or not, if there is more investment or not, with investment is higher quality, building up inventories of lower quality, and then also look at past data. If we have big revisions to Q1, either to the even deeper into the downside or to the upside, it could create a lot more of confusion in the markets. And it's important to note the timing. We have 15 minutes before the GDP release, we have the ADP non-farm payrolls, which are expected to hit 230,000, a bit lower than last month's 280,000. And later in the day, we have the Fed decision that we talked about. So I think we'll have a strong reaction to the headline figure, and then some confusion as markets dig deeper into the GDP numbers, mix it together with ADP, mix it with expectations towards the FOMC. So in general, Wednesday should be a very, very exciting day in the markets.
Oh, that's cool. So in regards to, if you already talked about the non-farm payroll reports, we should see another big gain of over 200,000 in jobs. And the inflation rate, what, we're going to see it remaining around the 6.1% or continue to crawling a little bit further down?
Well, official market expectations are for a gain of about 230,000-240,000 in the official non-farm payrolls, and an unemployment rate at 6.1%. I believe we'll see even a bit higher, maybe 250,000. The unemployment rate, hopefully it'll stay at the same level and will be accompanied by a rise of the participation rate. The participation rate is at the 1978 lows of 62.8%. This is rock bottom. It has been at this level quite a few times. A good sign for the economy in general will be that it picks up. But in general, I think that the initial reaction will be towards the headline non-farm payrolls number. If the number is above 300,000, it'll be dollar positive no matter what. If it'll be below 200,000, it'll be dollar negative no matter what. If it'll be somewhere in the middle, which is base case scenario, I think that other figures will take control, and it's not the unemployment rate and not the participation rate. As you've mentioned, as you've hinted before, the focus will move to the inflation numbers. So, together with the same BLS report, we have the release of average hourly earnings. That means how much money people actually make, and that's an important factor. So the annual level stands at 2%, or month over month, it has been around 0.2% for quite a long time. The Fed would like to see a pickup in these numbers in order to indicate that core inflation is really rising. It means that people have more money in their pockets and not just low-paying jobs. Another report, a separate report, comes from a different institution, the BEA, and that's the report that includes personal income, personal expenditure, and the now increasingly important core PCE price index.
Oh, yeah. This is the one that Yellen, suddenly she talked about it, and it's like the Kardashian talking about some product, and now everybody buys it. So now Yellen talked about the personal consumption expenditure, and now we all talk about the PCE, the core PCE, because, yeah, Yellen talked about it. So this is our nerdy version of the Kardashians talking up about someone else or about consumer goods.
Yeah, if Kim says so, in this case Janet, well,
yeah, or
we're
one of them
for it. Yeah.
That's exactly. So yeah, so Yellen is our Kardashian, and my apologies to Yellen, of course. So
yeah,
yeah. But the last time I remember it was in the May. For May, it was around 1.5%, right? The core PCE.
Exactly.
So that wasn't too impressive, and I think I don't know if it's really that important, or maybe because Yellen wanted to keep us keep all the hawks away from her, and she said, oh, no, don't worry about the core CPI. It's 1.9%, yes, but the core PCE is 1.5%. So because it's still lower than our target, ergo, we don't need to start raising the interest rate, so back off. I think that maybe that was her plan. What do you think?
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, the core PCE price index has always been important, but with inflation becoming less important in recent years, sort of a little bit irrelevant to monetary policy for some time. That's a bit extreme to say, but that's how things were. And employment was more in the limelight. It sort of lost its shine, but now that Yellen mentioned it, it became more important. And I think, yeah, she's a dove, like her predecessor, as you said before, and she would rather have us look at the weaker inflation number rather than the stronger one. So now it's standing at 1.5%. Any pickup in this number will be, of course, dollar positive and will strengthen the hawks. And if there's no change or if the figure falls, it'll be dollar negative. It's usually not the most important figure. It's important when it stands on its own. This time it's a bit overshadowed by the non-farm payrolls. This figure will have, in my opinion, a significant impact. If the non-farm payrolls comes more or less within expectations, around 250%, or even anywhere between 200 and 300,000. So the top tier figure is NFP, and afterwards the inflation numbers.
I'll just add up in regards to non-farm payroll reports that usually they tend to have also a negative relation with gold and silver. So because if the U.S. economy continues to expand, people are less inclined to invest investments that are considered safe havens, such as gold and silver, and usually they have a strong correlation. So as you said, if you also see a sharp gain in non-farm payroll reports of over 200 or even 300, there'll be even more of a boost to the economy from the labor market. We could see a sharp reaction and a decline in gold and silver. At least that was the case last month, and in most months there was a strong correlation between a strong negative correlation between these two figures. So, well, interesting to see how precious metals will react, and of course the U.S. dollar, as you said. Okay, so that's all the time we have. Thank you, Yochai, as usual.
Thank you, Leo.
Okay, until next time, you're more than welcome to join us, subscribe, and listen to past episodes on our websites. And that's it. Until next time, this is Leo signing off for Yochai, saying goodbye and have an excellent week.
For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make Market Movers possible.